this is actually going to be two talks. It's going to be a bit of a refrain of a talk I gave at Usenix Security last year, but I'm going to talk about more about how we did it than about what we actually found. So the first thing I should mention is, actually, before I mention, I should mention that this is all joint work with Sandy Clark, Travis Goodspeed, Perry Metzger, Zach Wasserman, and Kevin Zhu at the University of Pennsylvania. All of these are phenomenally talented people who you should try really, really hard to hire when they are looking for work. This work that I'm going to be doing is part of a larger research project called Security in Open Telecommunications Networks at both the UPenn and Penn State. The aim is to analyze security in open telecommunications networks of all kinds. The folks at Penn State looked at cell phones. We decided to look at other. And it's funded by the National Science Foundation. Now, what I should say is that because we're funded by the federal government, I am legally required to tell you a disclaimer that nothing I say represents the views of the United States government. And in this particular case, that is almost certainly very true. So with that disclaimer, the work that I'm going to be talking about and what we analyzed is a system a little bit different from what we are used to when we look at internet and general purpose computing systems called APCO Project 25. APCO stands for the Association of Public Safety Communications Officers. It's a consortium of vendors and public safety agencies and so on. And presumably there were 24 projects like this that preceded it, although the last one that anybody documented was called Project 16, so I don't know, maybe this is not in Base 10 or something like that. It's a standard for digital two-way radio, and in particular, it was intended to be a replacement for the public safety and land mobile two-way radio systems that use analog modulation, and is as a result of needing to be compatible with that, or needing to be compatible with the spectrum allocation for that, has some constraints that kind of disadvantaged the security of the system from the very start, which I'll be talking about. So we'll be seeing a lot of familiar themes throughout this talk of things like backwards compatibility causing security problems, and you know, bad policies causing security problems, and you know, people not talking to each other about what the requirements actually should be causing security problems. And then we'll take a look at what some of the security problems are, and we'll all want to move to some other country. Okay, so the Project 25 was started in the early 1990s. By about 2000, commercial equipment for Project 25 started coming out. This is a picture of a kind of a typical, almost current generation handheld P25 radio. You know, you look at it and it looks kind of like a standard police walkie-talkie type radio. There are a few vendors. Mostly, but not exclusively, in the United States. Motorola is probably the dominant vendor to the federal government, which is one of the biggest customers of for equipment like this, and also in the state and local markets for that. But even though there are a bunch of different vendors, there's a standard that they're all implementing, and in fact, there are reference implementations that different vendors are following. So even equipment that has a different brand name on it has often got an implementation that's essentially the same as somebody else's equipment. So there isn't actually a lot of diversity among the equipment that meets this standard. So what's it used for? So the thing we think of for two-way radio is the police dispatch and you know, fire departments and local ambulances and so on. And they're intended to be one of the main users of this. But it's also intended to be a standard that in which kind of one size fits all for all users of two-way radio. And that turned out to include both the military and other very sensitive agencies of the federal government. So I went and did a Google image search looking for pictures of the Motorola P25 radios and in like news reports and things like that. So the two favorite ones I came up with are on the left. There's a picture from Afghanistan of some warfighters and very prominently on the backpack of the Marine in the front is the same radio that I showed you a picture of. The second picture is a Secret Service agent at a formal event, presumably not one as formal as the reception tonight, but they make do at the White House. This is a picture of the back of the evening gown of a Secret Service agent stuck very discreetly in the back of her evening gown. You can see one of these Motorola XTS 5000 radios. So at the other end of that little coiled earpiece that the Secret Service has, that's what's at the other end of it. And interestingly, this picture was actually made available from the White House at high resolution. You can actually zoom in and see where the crypto switch is set if you look at that picture. So you can, the agent can't see it because it's on her back, but you can see it in the picture. Okay, so how does P25 work? So it's essentially intended to be spectrum compatible with the analog system that it replaces. The reason for that is they want some users to be able to switch over to P25 systems without requiring every radio user, every two-way radio user in the United States, regardless of what frequency they're using or where they're located, to switch over all at once. So in order to prevent that, they basically didn't do what you would normally do if you were designing a digital two-way radio system from scratch, which would be to use spread spectrum or some very wide bandwidth technology that basically spreads a signal over a wide frequency range but requires that there not be narrow users in the spectrum band that you're using. They couldn't do that with P25 because there isn't an empty set of spectrum large enough to accommodate that without kicking out all of the existing users of the analog systems all at once. So instead, what they designed was a digital modulation scheme that works on individual small channels the same way that standard analog radios work. So it basically uses a 12.5, the current version uses a 12.5 kilohertz wide channel, which is a narrow channel. There's also a version that uses a channel that's on average half that size for the version 2 of the protocol. But basically what it's doing is sending 9600 bit per second digital data, with the most prominent service built on top of that being a vocoded voice. So 9600 bits per second digital data with a vocoder called IMBE, which kind of provides reasonable quality speech at that data rate and allows anybody receiving it to decode that and get the speech out of their radio. Basically, it does not do any of the things that you would think of a standard digital protocol as doing. It doesn't have handshakes or acknowledgments. It's not TCP. Instead, it's a broadcast protocol in which the voice is basically divided up into 180 millisecond frames, which, if you do the math, are 1,728 bits long. And it essentially, while you're talking, it's just transmitting one of these 180 millisecond frames after another. If you tune in after the transmission is started, no problem. You'll miss what you didn't get when it started, but you'll be able to pick up at the beginning of the next 180 millisecond frame. And so that lets you, it introduces basically 180 millisecond delay, but it's essentially real-time voice that you can pick up right in the middle. And again, it's a broadcast model. There's no notion of a session. This is intended so that every person transmitting is going to be receivable by every person on the channel who receives it, without requiring that the receivers engage in any kind of two-way protocol. So even though these are two-way radios, it's a one-way protocol. Okay, so how does the security work in this system? So security is an option, and that, you know, as a security person, as soon as I hear security is an option, I get very excited because it means, oh, I'm going to get to write a paper, unless somebody else got to write the paper first. And how does this work? Well, why is security an option? Why do government agencies not need security built into their two-way radio systems all the time? Well, it turns out mostly they don't. Local police and fire and ambulance, for the most part, don't want their communication systems to be encrypted or unreadable by anyone, because their chief problem is making sure that messages get through rather than keeping unauthorized messages out. Local police dispatch there's no real need to encrypt local police dispatch. You know, there's a burglary in progress at the Sheraton Hotel, because the people responding to that have lights and sirens on their cars. It's not going to be, you know, nothing they do is going to be secret for all that long. And they interoperate with other agencies. We want to make sure that, you know, the other local police departments can help them when necessary. So they generally don't want anything that's going to require things like key distribution that might prevent messages from getting through if the keys aren't available to those who need them. But if we go back a couple slides, you'll notice that it's not just local agencies that end up using this. The military, for example, does not generally have the attitude that we'd rather the message get through than be secure. We don't care if the enemy can hear what our plans are. You know, they often actually want to keep stuff secret that they're talking about. Similarly, the people protecting, you know, high-level government officials often want their messages to be secure. And people doing surveillance, you know, the FBI and so on, doing surveillance on, you know, cryptographers or whoever it is that they're watching, often want their surveillance operations to be kept secret. So even though the vast majority of users don't need any security features, some of the users who end up using this want the security features a lot. So we've got this technology which the vast majority of customers don't want or need any security, and in fact are better off without it, and some customers where this is an absolute requirement off of the top. Okay, so how does the security work for those who want it? So this protocol was first designed, and the architecture for it was first envisioned in 1990. 1990 was before there was efficient enough implementation of public key crypto systems to be able to automatically assume that you would use it. So everything is based on symmetric encryption. So in other words, on secret key encryption, DES at the time it was designed, AES, the advanced encryption standard today, in which keys have to be loaded into the radios, crypto keys have to be loaded into the radios before you can use them. There's no mechanism for negotiating a key over the air without pre-arranging a secret at the place that's going to be receiving it. Now, there are two ways to load keys into these radios, and neither of them are very easy. So one way to load keys into the radio is to get this big cumbersome device called a key loader and physically attach it to the radio and load the key in. Another way is with a protocol called over-the-air rekeying, which allows you to essentially update the keys once the keys have been loaded to change them over time, but it requires that this had been bootstrapped with manual loading of keys. Because again, unlike systems like RSA and Diffie-Hellman, that allow you to negotiate a key from scratch without any secrets already in place. This is making the assumption that you're just using secret key cryptography. There are also provisions to use government classified crypto, but again, assuming that keys are loaded in advance. As I mentioned before, this is a broadcast protocol. There are no sessions because the one transmitter is talking to many different receivers. So the sender radio does all of the work. The person who's talking, their radio makes all of the security decisions. It's up to the receiver, if it's encrypted, to figure out how to decrypt it. If the transmitter decides to encrypt something, then it's encrypted no matter what the capabilities of the receivers are. And if the transmitter isn't encrypted, then it goes out in the clear. Now, there are two interesting decisions behind this. The first is that they're going to err on the side of messages getting through. And what that means is that you will aggressively decrypt and play messages so that you can play them if at all possible. So on the receiver side, if you receive clear messages, you'll always play them according to the standard. If you receive a clear transmission, you should always demodulate that and put that over your local speaker, even if you yourself are in encrypted mode. And if you are in the clear mode or encrypted mode and you receive an encrypted transmission, if you have the key to decrypt it on your radio, you should decrypt it. So even if you're in the clear mode, if you receive an encrypted transmission and you have the key because it's been loaded into your radio, you should use the key and play it. So the idea is to err very much on the side of allowing communications to happen rather than err on the side of having the receiver and, behavior linked to the transmit behavior. There's no authentication anywhere in the system. There's no protection against things like replay. There's no assurance that the identifier that a radio has is actually the correct identifier. The encryption is used entirely for confidentiality. It doesn't include any of the authentication protocols. Now, if you're not a cryptographer, you might react to that by saying, "Okay, what's the big deal?" But if you are a cryptographer, you'll notice that this is one of the things that you hear, and you say, "Oh, I'm going to get to write a paper." So, how secure is this? Well, I could kind of stop here and say that we've already got a few clues about some potential security problems, both fundamental. There's no authentication, and also usability. But we got to write a paper anyway. And our paper basically examines the design and the crypto in detail, and I talked about that at Usenix Security, and you know there's something you can read, so I'm not gonna spend too much time here repeating this. The sort of overall problem is that it's an ad hoc design, and I think that's very important, because ad hoc designs aren't automatically not secure, but they're very, very difficult to make secure when you start to look at them systematically. And this was quite clearly an ad hoc design, and in fact, we were able to find quite a bit of leverage in there. And we found that the good news is that there were some mistakes that obviously were not made. So, you know, for example, when messages are supposed to be, when messages are encrypted, they seem to be using the actual encryption protocols, the actual crypto modes of operation, in a reasonably good way. They're not reusing initialization vectors with stream ciphers, which is one of the ways that these protocols can kind of subtly fail. And they don't actually seem to be making some of the obvious use of crypto mistakes. But there are some significant protocol weaknesses. Some revolve around the lack of authentication. Some have to do with the susceptibility to what we call traffic analysis, and I'll talk a lot about how we exploited the traffic analysis stuff in practice. It turns out radio IDs are sent in the clear even when the radios themselves are supposed to be in encrypted mode, but we seem to have been the first people to notice that they were actually going out in the clear. And there's also a way to get inactive radios to identify themselves to you over the air. So even non-transmitting radios will reveal information about themselves. And we found some denial of service attacks that make them highly susceptible to jamming. So those were some interesting technical problems with the protocol itself. But more interestingly, we discovered that the usability issues of the radio, the user interface and the user experience of trying to make an encrypted transmission reliably happen was so poorly done that that this can be exploited quite readily in reality, and so we did that. Okay, so let's look at some practical attacks that we found. The first is that there's no authentication. So voice traffic is encrypted for confidentiality, but it's not authenticated. And what that means is that when you receive a message, you really have no assurance that it came from where you thought it did, other than the sound of the voice that you're hearing. You don't have any you don't have any cryptographic assurance that it is where it came from, and therefore there's also no protection against things like replaying messages that have been heard before. That is, if you take an encrypted message off the air, you can't decrypt it yourself, but if you can guess what the content is, you can now play it back in the correct voice just by retransmitting the bits over the radio, and no one will be able to tell that this is an old message. So if you've got the if you guess when they've transmitted the message, okay, that Matt Blaze guy has gone to bed, we can stop watching him for the day. I could just retransmit that all the time. And in fact, that's how I got the FBI off my back. More seriously, the received identifier, the radios transmit a unique identifier along with each transmission, that's not authenticated at all. And in fact, even if radios are in the encrypted mode, the fact that they'll play clear messages means that you can insert traffic of your choosing at any time you'd like. So that's a sort of first consequence of the lack of authentication. But if we dig down a little deeper, that might lead us to some other interesting mischief that we could perform. One of the things, if you talk to people in the intelligence community, people at the at agencies like the National Security Agency, whose job is to listen in on the communications of foreign, hopefully government officials, and try to make sense of what our adversaries are doing. They lost the crypto battle a long time ago. That is, for the last 50 years, governments have been using effectively unbreakable encryption for the vast majority of the encrypted traffic that they want to use. Militaries, occasionally have weak encryption, but code breaking in the traditional Bletchley Park World War II sense in the military and government and intelligence context is pretty much been overtaken by pretty good encryption that's out there. But that doesn't mean if you go over to Maryland, you'll notice there's this giant building full of cryptographers in Fort Meade, and if you get too close to it, they'll chase you away. They employ thousands of people who are still actually producing really good intelligence based on intercepted encrypted traffic. What are they doing? Well, they're doing something, a lot of what they're doing is what's called traffic analysis. They're looking at the patterns of who's talking to who, which can often be more revealing than what's actually being said. You know, a very simple example is we can learn quite a bit about somebody just by who they email with and who they call on the telephone without knowing anything about what the content of their messages is. We can get an idea of what their social network looks like. We can get an idea of who the leader of a group of people is, who are kind of at the outset of it. We can link people together via other people. And that type of analysis is actually, in many ways, more powerful than outright interception of content, because, first of all, it can be automated. You don't have to actually listen to it in real time. And secondly, it reveals things that to a person won't be obvious out of, taking one message out of context, but builds up this sort of better and better picture over time. So traffic analysis against a really sophisticated adversary is actually a more serious problem than intercepting your communication. And P25 appears to have been designed to make traffic analysis as delightfully easy as possible. So every radio has a unique unit identifier. It can be programmed into the radio when it's configured, but the federal government has a numbering plan for these radios that essentially gives each radio a unique identifier that isn't just a serial number of the radio, but has some structure that we discovered after a while identifies the agency that owns it and in some cases, the particular office within that agency that's using it, and in some cases, the individual squad within an office that's using it. And radios are in many of these agencies issued to individual people, so you can kind of use these unit identifiers as a proxy for individual people, and you can kind of tell, oh, so-and-so has a new job. They're now working with these other people by looking at who they're communicating with over time. Now, the standard says that if the radio is sending an encrypted transmission, the unit identifier is supposed to be encrypted. But we actually found that that's not actually true. The unit identifier seems to be encrypted by sending it in the clear. So I guess that's a form of encryption. It's not a very good form of encryption, but
double
rot 13, that's right. Yes. We were able to crack that encryption pretty easily, and we were able to kind of keep track of all of these identifiers over time. So that allows you to passively keep track of what's going on. And if you were to add some radio direction finding to this, which is fairly straightforward, you need two phased array antennas at fixed locations that can tell you which direction it's coming from. And if you've got two of them, the radio itself provides a third point, and you can effectively triangulate the location. That will also tell you where they're located when they're transmitting. But we also discovered that due to some protocol errors, it's possible to send a malformed data packet on the voice service that will cause a radio to send back a negative acknowledgement to the data transmission. It'll essentially send you back a message, I'm sorry, there's a checksum error there, please retransmit, I am user ID, whatever this is. So you can effectively ping even idle radios to actively find out where they're located. So this is due to Margot Seltzer, the name of this. When I described this to her last year, she said, "Oh, you're building the Harry Potter Marauders map." So here, the ping that's sent back from one of these radios is of sufficient duration to allow you to direction find where it's coming from. So if you think the government is surveilling you, you can send these pings out and effectively get a map of where the agents are located at any given time, even when they're idle. Now, that may or may not be a threat in the law enforcement environment. I mean, a reasonable question, is your local drug dealer likely to actually do this to find out where the cops are located? Maybe, maybe not. But remember that the military is using these as well. In general, the military likes to keep the locations of troops quiet until until they're not quiet anymore. And you know, so this might actually be a significant threat there. Okay, so the next protocol problem that we found was denial of service. So radio denial of service is an interesting problem. There's a bit of an arms race in a typical denial of service analysis between the person who wants to deny service and the person who wants to protect their transmissions from denial of service. And it's essentially a war of power. So in a traditional FM radio system, that is the systems that P25 is intended to replace, this is a pretty much an equally matched arms race. The jammer needs to be able to deliver a tiny bit more power at the receiving location than the legitimate transmitter. And basically that means that if you want to reliably jam something, you have to either get closer to the receiver than the real transmitter or overpower the real transmitter some way. And as I mentioned before, with direction finding, if you do this, you're exposing yourself to being tracked down, and often the people using this are not friendly when they find you. So it's a somewhat risky proposition to be jamming a two-way radio system that's being used by somebody who's trying to do surveillance against you, for example. First of all, it makes you really easy to find, and secondly, it's eventually you're going to need bigger and bigger batteries and more antennas and so on. But P25 is designed to make itself even more resistant to jamming, and in fact, what they use are error correction codes. There's a lot of redundancy in a P25 transmission, and part of the intent is to make that more robust against things like signal dropouts and so on. But it's also intended to make it a little bit harder to jam, because the error correction codes will fill in bits if a jammer is trying to interfere with it. But unfortunately, there's a fundamental mistake in the design of the error correction that actually ends up having the opposite effect and making it easier to jam than the system that it replaced. There are individual subfields in each of those 1728-bit voice frames that happen every 180 milliseconds. It's not all one big error-corrected blob. It's a bunch of separately error-corrected blobs. And the first of those error-corrected blobs is a 12-bit field that, after error correction, is 64 bits long, called the NID. I think it stands for Network Identifier. And that basically says, this is a voice frame. So it's a 12-bit thing. It says, this is a voice frame. Its network code is such and such. The rest of this transmission is going to be a voice frame. So out of those 1728 bits, in roughly the first 64 of those bits is all the information required to tell you what the rest of this is. So it turns out a jammer can jam that separately if they can time synchronize it adequately. And then you can just stop jamming it. So essentially every 180 milliseconds you have to obliterate the 64 bits, and the receiver then won't be able to make any sense of the remaining 1600 and whatever it is bits in that 180 milliseconds, as long as you've timed it correctly. And fortunately, right before those 64 bits is a little frame synchronizer that says, I'm about to send you those 64 bits. So you need a receiver that's listening for this, and then the ability to blast out this little thing. Now, if you do the energy calculation, which is how engineers who do jamming resistance calculate this, we talk about the number of decibels of advantage or disadvantage that the jammer has. You typically want to design a system so that the jammer is at a disadvantage of some number of decibels, 10 or 20, or in a really well-designed system, 30 decibels. That is, you have to be that much, use that much more energy than the thing you're trying to jam. In P25, there's a 14 decibel disadvantage to the legitimate user. You need 14 decibels less energy than the thing you're trying to jam over time to do this, which isn't good. And in fact, there are spread spectrum systems that reverse this quite a bit. So that's in theory, but you might say, oh, but this is going to require, you know, this really precise over-the-air timing. You're going to need zillions of dollars worth of equipment. You know, maybe, you know, in your fancy lab in Philadelphia, you can build you could get this with thousands and tens of thousands of dollars of equipment. And, you know, I love to have an excuse to buy tens of thousands of dollars worth of cool equipment, but it turns out Travis, one of the grad students who worked on this, disappointed me and figured out how to do it a lot cheaper. How hard is it to build one of these jammers? So it turns out TI, Texas Instruments, makes a chip called the CC1110. It's a single chip digital radio transceiver that supports a protocol that isn't quite P25, but it's very close to P25. And it uses the same frame synchronization sequence as P25. So we could write some firmware. It has both a receiver and a transmitter in this chip that's basically got all you need if you put some firmware on top of it to act as a P25 jammer. It can recognize the starts of frames, and then it can transmit some garbage to receive it, and then you'd have to hook up a little RF amplifier on the output to make it larger. Now, TI charges, or charged at the time we looked, something like $90 a chip in single unit quantities for the developer kit for it, which is a great deal if you want to jam P25 transmissions. It's way cheaper than the, ends of thousands of dollars of custom equipment that you'd otherwise need, but it still seemed like a little bit much for us. So we looked for things that used this chip, and it turns out there's a device called the GirlTech IMME, which is a little instant messenger toy that is aimed at preteen girls. Apparently boys don't like to instant message, but girls do, according to the toy marketing scheme. It uses this chip, and it includes this chip in it, and they cost $30 for two. You buy them in pairs. So $15 each will buy you this thing, and it even includes a little display and keyboard on it, so that you can have it be the little GirlTech device. So we loaded some custom firmware into this to turn this into the My First Jammer. The thing is really cute. The box actually has unicorns on it that it comes in. It actually works. So you can kind of take these $10,000 radios and defeat them with this $15 instant messaging toy. How would you actually use this? So remember that the protocol lets clear messages through even when there's encrypted messages going on. So one of the things that you might want to do with your jammer is not actually just be terribly disruptive, but rather encourage the people that you're trying to interfere with to go into the clear mode. And so one way to do that is to just jam the encrypted transmissions to convince the users of the radio that there's something wrong with the encryption, they need to change to the clear mode. So one of the things we programmed My First Jammer to do was recognize only encrypted transmissions and only jam those. And so the scenario we envisioned was to tune these to the local FBI channel. We didn't actually do this. And then buy a bunch of them and tape them to taxi cabs surreptitiously going around the city to just convince the government that, oh, the encryption doesn't work again. We got to go back to the clear mode. But we didn't actually do that. I hasten to say. But we were able to configure it very easily to do that. Okay, so what about usability in practice? So this symbol is not just the null set. It turns out to be either the user interface symbol for the encryption is on or the symbol for the encryption is off. There is apparently disagreement among the user community about what this symbol actually means, because it isn't actually explained anywhere. Okay, so there were some potential usability problems that we that you could see from the standard. One is that there's not feedback about the state of the crypto in your own radio. There's a switch on your radio to control encryption, but it only controls outgoing encryption. It doesn't do anything to what you're receiving. And so you don't actually have any way to tell what that switch does on your radio without actually checking with someone else. You can't tell whether or not you're going into encrypted or clear mode because it doesn't have any effect on what you're receiving. You're always going to receive clear signals whether you're in encrypted mode or not. And if you've got keys, you'll always receive encrypted signals even if your switch is in the clear position. Secondly, another related usability problem is that the federal government, some of you may have heard, the federal government is a somewhat rigid and bureaucratic organization at times. And it has very clear standards for things like how often you should have to change your password and things like that. And we all know that making users change their passwords frequently is the best way to keep computing systems secure. And in fact, the more sensitive and important what users are doing, the more often they should be made to change their passwords. And in fact, that same very sound thinking, for which there is no evidence whatsoever, that causes people to blindly give this terrible security advice: change your password every 6 minutes if you're doing sensitive things, has led the federal government to develop standards that basically say keys have to be changed every month for agencies that are doing sensitive things, and more frequently for agencies that are doing very sensitive things. But if you recall, it's actually difficult to change the keys, and everybody has to have the same keys. So that may be a usability difficulty that causes some problems in practice. So in fact, if you look at the P25 design, and then you go and read a paper from Usenix Security 1999 by Doug Tigar with Alma Witten. Alma is now at Google. They wrote this paper called Why Johnny Can't Encrypt. And they basically looked at the PGP email system, which was at the time pretty much the only way to encrypt email. We're trying to figure out why people couldn't use it. And they came up with a basically list of design guidelines for security user interfaces that the P25 design appears to have used as a checklist of things to avoid doing. So there's no feedback to the user. That was one of the things that the PGP analysis that Witten and Tigar did. There's no way to notice or help somebody who's in the clear mode because you can't really tell what mode that they were coming in. There are some ineffective alerts. So for example, you can put on the display of the radio, which is out of your view when you're listening to it, a little icon that appears when a received message comes in the clear versus encrypted. There's a way to configure the radios to beep if you're in the clear mode, but that's also the same beep for low battery. And if you remove the battery from the radios, it erases the keys. So when you hear that beep, you may change the battery on your radio. If it takes you more than 30 seconds to put in the new battery, that thing that was warning you in the clear will never go away because now you've just erased your encryption keys. So there are some interesting usability weaknesses there. So I'll give you an idea of what the user interface of this radio looks like. This is the Motorola XTS-5000. It was the state-of-the-art radio when we started for this. I got a bunch of them. Here's a picture of the radio in clear mode. Here we are in encrypted mode. So I'll go back so you can see the difference. So here we are in clear mode. Here we are in encrypted mode. And the only difference is there's this There's this little icon of a zero with a slash through it that appears on the display, and there's also a switch on the top of the radio, neither of which you can actually see when you're using the radio that tells you what mode the thing is in. And then there's the problem of cumbersome keying and keying failure. If the over-the-air rekeying protocol that's mandated to be used more frequently the more sensitive you are fails for even one user, then everyone has to go into the clear until it can be picked back up. Okay, so what did we do? Well, at the Crypto 95 conference, which is the big conference of cryptographers in 1995, Bob Morris, the father of that Robert Morris, was a bigwig at the NSA, and he gave a talk at Crypto 95, and he promised to reveal the National Security Agency's first rule of cryptanalysis, how they break enemy systems. And so as soon as he said that, everybody, you know, kind of perked up in their seats and started getting ready to take notes. And he said, the NSA's first rule of cryptanalysis, look for clear text. And everybody kind of groaned. But I actually remembered that when he said that, and we decided to apply that to P25 systems. You know, how much clear text is actually going out there on these systems that look like they're actually fairly susceptible to accidental clear text? So, you know, that's something you can do if you're the National Security Agency, right? This is something you're going to want to do. Record all of the enemy's transmissions, all their sensitive radio traffic, and hope that there were some mistakes and see what you can learn when the mistakes come in. So, the thing is, to do that, you kind of have to be a government. You've got to have the budget of, you know, $17 gazillion to put receivers in different locations and intercept, you know, scoop in all of these transmissions and then have a team of analysts. So I had a few $1,000 budget and a bunch of grad students, and we tried to do the same thing. So what do? So we found that there were some attacks in the protocols that we think are serious, and they were, you know, worth noting and worth writing about. But the active attacks that we discover realistically require a fair amount of expertise to exploit. Building, you know, the thing that pings radios to get the map of their location, building the jammer. We were able to, you know, build it out of cheap parts. But, you know, we were pretty determined to do this. This is probably this week at least out of the range of your average drug dealer and so on. So, you know, it's probably not an immediate this week threat in the active attacks, but I think, you know, at some point it will be. The more serious question is, how much of the weaknesses in this protocol can, as a practical matter, just be exploited passively without resorting to any of the fancy stuff? That is, just by somebody who's only receiving and only using off-the-shelf commercial equipment, just how much can you learn about the sensitive operations of the federal government? And what we found out was quite a bit, and that there's a significant volume of very sensitive law enforcement and national security traffic that regularly goes out in the clear with their users unaware that it's going out in the clear. So they think they've got the security of encryption, but in fact they're just going out in the clear, and all you need to exploit it is a P25 receiver tuned to the correct channel. Okay, so we discovered, actually, 2 years ago, we inadvertently misconfigured a P25 radio that we bought. We got the frequency that we were trying to program in to play with it off by 10 megahertz. And the radio didn't work to talk with each other. And just before we were going to reprogram the radio, we figured out what we had done wrong. Stuff starts coming over the receiver. And we start hearing, you know, not us talking, but we start hearing these people who sound, you know, like feds talking. And you know how they talk in the movies? It turns out that's how they talk. And they were doing some sort of surveillance operation, and they were giving names of streets that were like 10 blocks away from where we were. And this is kind of interesting. It's like having our own private version of The Wire. So this turned out not to be a fluke event. So what we did was we decided to collect systematic data about all of the P25 radio traffic going over the air in a number of different cities. We decided, well, what would it take for us, just a university, not a national government, not a foreign intelligence agency, and I might add, most importantly, not willing to break any laws, what would it take for us to collect all of the traffic and follow Bob Morris's first rule of NSA cryptanalysis, look for clear text? So we decided, first of all, we only care about the federal government. So we're going to limit ourselves, you know, we're not going to listen to any state and local stuff. We're only going to get the frequencies used by the federal government, and we're going to only listen to the sensitive traffic of the federal government. We, you know, the National Park Service, I mean, yes, they're very important, but, you know, we're not going to try to break their transmissions. You know, the Postal Service, again, in spite of going postal as an expression, we're not going to regard them as a sensitive organization. We want the FBI and the Secret Service and the DEA and so on. Now, how do you identify what the frequencies used by the sensitive agencies are? Well, it turns out it's rule number two, or Blaze's rule number one, look for ciphertext. So the channels that mostly have ciphertext on them are the ones that you want to listen for the clear text on. So what did we do? So we found that there's one receiver on the market that's cheap and of good enough quality that it was feasible for us to deploy a bunch of them. ICOM, which is a company that makes two-way radio equipment and also hobbyist radio equipment, makes a software controllable receiver that has a P25 board that you can put in it to demodulate P25 transmissions. It's just this little black box radio that you can hook up to a computer and control over a USB port and get audio out of it. So, and covers the frequency range used by P25 by the federal government. So there are 2,000 roughly channels allocated exclusively to the federal government for P25 and other use. Over 24 megahertz of spectrum, the channels are every 12.5 kilohertz. And this is for all federal government two-way radio use in metropolitan areas. The coverage radius of this is typically, you know, a city or roughly a city. Now, this is all federal stuff. This includes things like the post office and the park service and so on. And mixed in with that is the sensitive stuff. Some of the frequencies used by different agencies are widely known. It turns out there's a website called radioreference.com, which is, as you might imagine, just what it says it is, in which people can kind of add like a wiki of frequencies they've discovered. A lot of it is wrong. So we decided deliberately to just ignore the published sources and work kind of from first principles, look for ciphertext and then find the clear text within it. So it was pretty easy, actually, to identify these channels. We found that in each city that we put these receivers in, within a couple of months, we'd find between 1 and 200 channels of these 2,000 that have predominantly encrypted traffic on them, but that occasionally have some clear text that pops up on them. So then we bought a bunch of these receivers after we did a survey to find the channels in different cities. And these were what cities? Well, I can't actually say what cities, except that they're, you know, the cities that we had friends in. And, you know, we could stick these receivers in. You know, if you had an apartment in a tall building, we wanted to be your friend. So stick this little black box in your window. Okay, so what did we do? Well, we configured a network of these receivers. We started out with three cities. We've ended up with a total of six that we've got running now. And we basically scan through all of the channels that have predominantly encrypted traffic, and we record every bit of metadata that appears on these channels, and also every clear voice transmission that comes through on these channels, which we record in audio form. And then every night, we upload this we wrote some custom software on to control the receivers to record all the metadata, and then we wrote some scripts to kind of every night upload our results from each of these locations to a server, and then we would spend the next day analyzing. We typically get somewhere between 20 minutes and an hour of clear traffic per day per city on these channels. So we would have our analysts sit there in their in our University of Pennsylvania Security Agency headquarters, our command center, kind of keep trying to make as much sense of this as we could. And we'd start to graph things, and we'd discover, oh, there are some patterns here, these unit identifiers. Oh, if it starts out with this, it's the FBI. If it starts out with this, it's the Department of Homeland Security. Oh, here's where the DEA is located. Oh, Frank, he's a member of a new squad this week. And we start to, we started to get to know these people. What we found was that there's an average of about 30 minutes, a mean of about 30 minutes per day of sensitive clear text in each city. And it doesn't seem to, it's irrespective of agency, it's irrespective of what city it's in. There's no agency that's particularly better or worse, with, it turns out, one exception. So I'll talk about the exception in a second. Let me just give you an idea of how sensitive is sensitive. So, you can imagine that a large amount of the activity of federal law enforcement, surveillance, and so on is fairly mundane, and that's true, but the non-mundane stuff is bone-chillingly sensitive. So we were able to get things like names and identifying features of their targets of surveillance, descriptions of undercover agents, in some cases the names of informants, which, that's the sort of thing that, really shouldn't be sent over the air in the clear. It turns out when they do a wiretap, what they typically do on somebody who's a surveillance target, so they'll typically broadcast the wiretap results over the air on a special channel that the surveillance people are listening to. Okay, he just made a call. They're going to do a deal in a few minutes, and so on. So it makes it very clear if you're that person. It would be very easy to identify that that's you that they're talking about. And a very wide range of crimes. Some of them, of what you would imagine to be not very sophisticated targets, but others, in the organized crime and counterterrorism range, that where you could imagine that their adversaries would be at least as sophisticated as a group of graduate students sitting in a lab somewhere and might be able to get a commercial receiver and just use it. And we got almost every agency. In fact, we got every agency except every law enforcement agency in the federal government whose identity, whose existence is public. Perhaps there's some super secret agency that we haven't heard of that manages to keep their encryption on, with the exception of one. Would anybody like to take a guess on which agency always has its encryption on? Oh, yeah, that would just be so great. If I'm ever president, I would hope that would be true by then. But no. The Park Service doesn't. The Weather Service does not, as far as I know, have a police force. But it's if they do, they're good. No, it turns out the postal inspector. We've never got a single thing out of the postal inspector. They are invisible. Do not screw with the postal inspector. Yeah. Okay. So mostly we were getting law enforcement traffic, but there's a smattering of sort of what they call national traffic thrown in there as well, counterterror and counterintelligence sort of stuff. Okay. So what's going on? Well, first of all, the first observation is we're pretty unsophisticated relative to who their adversaries are, right? A foreign intelligence service is certainly going to be able to do this. Our entire budget for buying equipment was, under $10,000, and we were able to cover several cities and get, a couple of years worth of fairly sensitive traffic and learned an awful lot about the operations of these agencies. So what's actually going wrong here? Well, it's not Much to our disappointment, this didn't involve any exploiting any of the things that we discovered that we would think of as being particularly clever. These were three categories of usability problems. The first was a single user error. It was very common for most of the users in an operation to be encrypted, but one or two of them to be going out in the clear. And that would often be enough to make sense of the rest of what was going on. But it was clear that the clear users were interoperating with the encrypted users. Everyone had the key, but somebody had their switch in the wrong position, and nobody was ever in a position to notice. The second was a group error where everyone was in the clear. There wasn't a single user going out in the encrypted mode, even though there would be references to having encryption capability in the radios, but there'd be references to an incorrect procedure for turning it on. Everyone put your radio in the zero without the slash through it, because that we've got to talk about sensitive stuff. We would often intercept that. And then finally, failure of the keying system. That is, one member of the group didn't manage to get this week or this month's encryption key because their radio didn't actually successfully complete the over-the-air rekeying protocol. Everyone else's did, though, which had the effect of erasing last month's key. So because last month's key gets erased when you load this month's key, if anybody is out of sync, the only way for everyone to communicate is for everyone to switch to the clear mode. And in fact, we would often hear toward the beginning of a month, we found out which agencies rekey on Tuesdays, which agencies rekey on Wednesdays. Those seem to be the two big days for this. We would hear, okay, I just rekeyed, so everybody switched their radio to the zero without the slash, because it takes about a week before it sets. So there's a bit of folklore about how this must work. And we found that basically between the keying failure, it was roughly 50-50 between user error and the keying failure problems. And this was enough to get us, about an average of about half an hour of sensitive clear traffic per day, along with 100% of the metadata, even for the encrypted traffic that we were getting each day, which would allow us to fill in quite a few of those details. So I should say that the radios are successful at encrypting most of the time, and that's not sufficient to actually protect their traffic. So we might look at this and say, well, what percentage of the traffic is encrypted? Well, it might be about 90%. And you might say, oh, 90%, that means that we're 90% secure. But we were actually able to use that as a wedge to make inferences with the 10% that we were getting, to make inferences about the rest of it that were very, very powerful. The other thing that we learned was that our lawyers are really nice people at the University of Pennsylvania. So one of the things that that occurred to us before we started deploying a network of black boxes to spy on the feds, that it might be a good idea to check on the legality of doing that. And it turns out there's a law that explicitly makes that legal. You're allowed to intercept law enforcement transmissions that are not encrypted, even if they should be encrypted. So so it was legal for us to do this. But of course, if you're a criminal and wanted to do something like this, even if it were illegal, that wouldn't be much of a barrier to you. So we developed some mitigation strategies, which we've been sharing with the federal government. I'd like to say that as a result of us talking to them, they've managed to successfully implement some of the mitigations, and the amount of, we're still collecting traffic, and that the amount of clear traffic that we're getting has been going down. Unfortunately, what happens is that I've been meeting lots of different federal agencies, my local FBI office, I'm on a first name basis with lots of people there, and various other agencies that we've intercepted. And what happens is that anytime we meet with them and talk about this, the amount of clear traffic we get goes rapidly down for about a week. And then it starts going up again and usually reaches a higher rate of clear transmission than when we started. And I'm not actually sure what's going on there. It's what seems to happen is that they remember after a while that there's something they need to do with the encryption, but they don't actually institutionally remember what that is. And they're more likely to now fiddle with the settings after about a week and get it more wrong than it was to start with. So actually, by trying to help, we've been doing more damage than we've been correcting, which is, you know, in a usability setting, usability is hard. So what are the lessons of this? We have about I'm going to stop real soon so that we can take a few questions and then go and on our cruise around wherever we're going for this reception. But there are a couple of lessons here. The first is that little wedges in security matter a lot. You know, things like a 90% secure turns out not to be very good against an adversary who's willing to be systematic. The second is being systematic is really helpful. So, you know, that's a sort of broad lesson, but it turns out that what we would have figured out is going on just by casually and haphazardly listening was not nearly as revealing as what we got by just being very slightly more systematic and trying to really do some analysis here. And you've always got to assume that that's what your adversary is going to be doing. And then finally, you know, things like, security folklore, like change your passwords frequently, can be more harmful than good. And this is an example where that was certainly pretty true. So I think we have 13 minutes and 48 seconds for either questions or for changing our clothes. So, yeah. Hi.
Hi, Matt. Mark Stavely. So it occurs to me that you don't actually need to jam every 180 millisecond packet. You mm-hmm. can jam a selective few of them because 180 milliseconds is relatively short. You get a little mm-hmm. beep if you don't jam it and it gets through.
Right.
So you can lower your energy requirements down significantly just by jamming every hundredth packet. And
Well, every hundredth would just cause little dropouts.
Yeah, okay. So,
but remember, you only have to jam for a tiny fraction of that 180 milliseconds, and it's automated. It's a minuscule amount of energy that you're putting out.
So in the cipher case, is the cipher per frame?
Or
is it block ciphered?
No, it's a stream cipher, but the IV
but
is reset in
every
each
frame.
Frame.
Yeah. And it also occurs to me that your super secret agency is probably hiding inside the postal inspector's office.
It might well be the postal inspector's office. Who knows what they do?
Just
the gentleman
question.
In the tux.
This might have been out of context of your research, but mm-hmm. did you find any evidence, or in talking to the agencies, find any evidence that these vulnerabilities that you discovered, which I hesitate to call them vulnerabilities if it's just clear text, were actually used by black cats for black cat reasons?
Yeah, we don't know. In a couple of cases, we heard over-the-air references to a belief that their target was sophisticated and taking countermeasures, but they were actually talking about that in the clear. So, you figure. Yeah.
Hi, you mentioned that the security mechanism, the secret keys, were, you know, these were developed in the early to mid-90s. Presumably, if you were to do a sufficient data capture of encrypted traffic, it sounds like a motivated but not even particularly well-funded organization could actually, you know, brute forcibly decrypt that data.
So certainly the DES traffic, you know, one of the ciphers is DES, and DES is within range of commercial level exhaustive search and, you know, has been understood to be in range for the last 15 years or so. AES, you know, which uses in the P25 standard, the 256-bit key, is certainly out of range of exhaustive search, and there's no known shortcut so far to doing that. But of course, you know, if you're at the level of an intelligence agency, it would certainly be prudent to collect all of that in the hopes that you'll have some future breakthrough.
Thanks.
Two questions. One, the U.S. Postal Service, you indicated that there was no drop back into plain text mode. Mm. Did you actually check for rekeying, or are they just using the same key that they started with?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, they don't rekey over the air in the postal inspector. That may be part of the reason for their success, or it may be that their radio procedures are just more disciplined. It's unclear. They don't seem to be rekeying that frequently.
Cool. Thank you. Where are the manufacturers of the IMME located? Because it seems to me that a really neat denial of service would be for you guys to insert some firmware that still gives the marketable functionality, but also does some jamming on the side.
Oh, you're evil.
Thank you.
Let's talk later.
Hi, Rick Farrow. Matt, how long have you been talking about this research where you put a bunch of the receivers and you collect information?
We've been talking about it publicly for about a year, and we were talking about it privately with the government for longer than that.
Sure. So a question about the scanning. This is a little bit related, unrelated, but a scanner essentially it's hopping frequencies, and you program it just to look at certain frequencies. So you're not continuously monitoring all these channels.
That's right. If we were better funded than we are, and certainly if anybody here is from a funding agency, I'd like to point out we could certainly be better funded than we are. We'd have dedicated individual receivers to each channel. So we, our 30 minutes a day is a lower bound.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, getting back to my first point. I really did these out of order, but it sounds like you and your graduate students have done a lot of really good traffic analysis, which makes you an interesting target to something like an advanced persistent threat type of adversary. So do you keep these machines on the internet?
So we took a fair amount of care in making sure, for example, that the machine that it's uploaded to, moves that kind of behind our firewall as quickly as possible. But certainly, we're a university. I mean, the easiest attack against us would be, apply to grad school at Penn, get accepted, and infiltrate my lab. And I take no precautions against that. But but that's probably harder than just getting your own damn receivers.
Yeah. I don't know. The grad student labor is really useful.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah.
Hi, Doug Hughes. I'm curious that the first time when you talked to, for instance, the FBI, and you said, "Oh, by the way, we'd really like to record your traffic over the air," what was their reaction?
Yeah, we didn't have that conversation. We mentioned, by the way, we've been doing this, and one of the things that we did was we went to our IRB, our Institutional Review Board, before we did this, and after talking to our general counsel that it would be, that it doesn't violate the law to do this, and we talked to the IRB, and we before we talked to them, we developed some guidelines of, look, we're collecting personally identifiable information, which by, even if it's benign, you have to be very careful about when you're doing research in a university. This is personally identifiable information that also identifies things like, people who might get whacked, So we wanted to really not reveal it to anyone. It turns out the real sensitivity is we're also identifying agents, federal agents who are making mistakes using their radios and could get in trouble for doing that. So we're interestingly allowed to talk to the government about generally what we're finding, but we can't actually share any of our recordings with them because that might get somebody into trouble at the, some of our research subjects, the people using these radios incorrectly, could get in trouble for doing that. So we're actually prohibited from weirdly, from sharing back with the government their own traffic because it could get people into trouble. So is that a good idea or not? I mean, does the harm outweigh the good? It's not clear, but those are the rules under which I kind of have to operate. Yeah.
Did you continue collecting traffic after you notified the various agencies, or until after you went public so that agencies could know that this was happening? And if you did collect information after, did you notice any change in their behavior?
Yeah, we're still collecting stuff. We've actually got a couple more receivers running now than we did. And every time I go to a hotel in a new city, I always ask for a high floor to get as much coverage as I can get. We're actually seeing the amount of traffic roughly flat with where it was when we started.
So you're not seeing any change in behavior?
Yeah. I mean, when we talk to them, we see a drop, and then it tends to go up a little bit after that, and then it starts to level back to the original level. So on that cheery note, great.
Hi, Matt, real quick. Yeah. Given that you guys came up with basically a jammer, had you considered coming up with a device you could give back to them that would identify when they're sending out unencrypted traffic so they could correct their own problems?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've done is we've shared our architecture with a couple of local offices, and what we've encouraged them to do is just replicate what we're doing. You know, that device we've got, you know, is a commercial product with a little bit of special software which we've made available to the federal government. Unfortunately, it turns out buying something for, you know, buying $1,000 worth of hardware is just as hard as buying, you know, $50,000 worth of hardware. And, you know, with the fiscal cliff and all, it's not easy. But the real hard part is that our software runs under Debian, and our collection software runs under Debian, which is not an approved operating system inside the federal government. So they, you know, we kind of have to smuggle them computers to let them use it. So on that cheerful note, let's all go on a boat ride. Okay.